Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you. One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Andy Murray, and you're listening to The Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello and welcome to The Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph. My name is David Law from BBC Radio 5 Live and BT Sport. I'm joined by Catherine Whittaker from Eurosport. We have just had, Catherine Whittaker, week one of the tennis season. How was it for you?
However good it was for me, David, it was probably even better for you, wasn't it? Because you were the one that was on the brink of exploding with anticipation. But yeah, I mean, it has to be said that no matter how exploding you were with anticipation, whether you were on the Catherine Whittaker end of the scale or the David Law end, it was pretty darn good, wasn't it, as first weeks of the season go?
It was. I would actually have to say it exceeded expectations, even from my expectations. And I spent about a month running pole vaults, 21 of them in total, just trying to keep up with my level of enthusiasm and satisfy it. And then eventually we had the first week. There were three men's tournaments, three women's tournaments, and the Hopman Cup. And most of them delivered. I mean, let's just start very quickly with the Doha final, because I think that has to be the best first week tournament final that I've ever seen.
It was relentless, wasn't it? I tweeted during the final that there should be a nap break for these guys. And what I basically was saying was, I need a nap because this is just exhausting to watch. But I mean, then by extension, if I need a nap, how on earth does Novak Djokovic feel right now? The level of tennis is just unreal. I mean, I do feel like they were hitting the ball that bit harder, both of them, than they usually do in matches against one another. Sometimes when those two have met in the past, they don't do their hardest hitting against one another. They take a few, you know, it's more about depth and tactics and angles and that sort of thing than it is about power. But it seems like they're doing all of that, but injecting a bit of extra power and muscle as well on the ball, which is just, I mean, bits of it were mind-boggling, absolutely mind-boggling. And the tussle, the changes in momentum and the mind games were going on. And the fact that even more than in the past, and it seemed impossible that it could be more so than it was in the past, but even more so, it's such a mental battle between those two, isn't it? You know, when Murray saved those match points in the second set and went on to take it to a third, you're just thinking, this is so mental, this game. I mean, the analysis that's there to be done, you know, if I was like a PhD student in sports psychology or something, I'd be all over that match. It was amazing. And I have to say, along with the esteemed Eurosport commentary team of Simon Reid and Fury McMillan, after he came back in that second set, I had Andy Murray as the heavy favourite to go on and take the match. So I really have to hand a lot to Djokovic for winning that in three.
And actually, I think, first of all, just to say, it ended up being, what, about 6-4 in the third, something like that, to Djokovic. But in the second set, I mean, he looked like he was going to win it in straight sets. And he actually referenced it in his post-match interview, didn't he, that in the previous match, he was the one who saved the match points against Fernando Verdasco, who must have been having nightmares. I mean, he had 5 match points, 4 of them in a row at 6-2 in a tiebreak against Djokovic, didn't take them, and he kind of threw it away. I mean, Djokovic did well, but still, Verdasco, you know, he knows he threw it away. And then the tables were turned. It was Djokovic who had multiple match points, albeit not in a row necessarily against Murray. He didn't take them. And I thought, I mean, Murray raised his level to something that... I feel as though, in a way, we've only seen that level since he's become world number one. That was defiance. That was Djokovic-like defiance, plus brilliance, inspiration. And he forced that final set. There were one or two rumblings on social media because I thought midway through the third set, I thought Murray is getting the better of this physically. It looked to me like Djokovic was starting to fade a little bit. A few people were saying, oh, well, Djokovic is play acting and being over dramatic and so forth. And I think he does, we've seen in the past, he does certainly let you know how he's feeling. He is a bit, I think, over dramatic at times. Frankly, I think Murray's been a bit over dramatic at times in the past. But I can't help thinking that the unusual ones are the ones that can just keep a straight face when all that disappointment and upset and stress is going on. Personally, I don't know about you.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think they're both guilty of that. Where you sit on that is up to you, I suppose. I think some people are pretty low tolerance on that, and some people are higher tolerance. I'm sort of probably somewhere in the middle. I don't enjoy watching someone sort of make a meal and you know, ostentatiously letting us know how they're feeling. But as long as the feelings behind it are genuine, which I think by and large they are, both with Murray and Djokovic, then I can live with it. If we're picking issues in behaviour, and Murray is by no means perfect, but we've done Murray's on-court behaviour to death, and it sort of remains. It actually was very, for him, it was pretty good yesterday. There was very little sort of chuntering to himself and to the box. So well done, Andy, for behaving like a sensible adult.
How far away do you think they were from the best?
I mean, that's an impossible question, because what you mean objective? There is no objective best. Your best is determined by what's across the net from you. So
I was amazed at the level, considering it was week one. Really, I suppose that's all you can say. Really.
But then look at Djokovic's performance against Nadal in the final last year. That his level was just as good, if not better. It's just the level across the other side of the net wasn't as good. He wasn't posed such a challenge by Nadal last year. But Djokovic's level in Doha last year was unreal. So yeah. So we do see high level tennis in week one of the season. We're just not used to seeing, I suppose, a battle of that nature. Just to finish an earlier point, and I won't labour it, because again, it's one of those things that everybody has their position on. Some people, I'm sure, it won't bother them at all. But the ball bouncing from Djokovic, regardless of your position on it, and it does annoy me when it was extreme as it was yesterday. From a psychological perspective, it's very interesting, I think, because it hasn't been that bad for years. It certainly hasn't been that bad for any of the years that he's been dominant in tennis. And how much do you read into it? It's easy to read it as a sign of stress. My instinct is to see the relationship between number of ball bounces before serve and stress as correlative. But maybe that's too simplistic. I don't know. But the fact is, regardless of to what level it bothers you, he is bouncing the ball now as much as he ever has. And he had toned it down for many years, hadn't he?
That's interesting. You know, I'll have to... were they referencing that in the commentary? Because I didn't really have the commentary up.
It took them a while to. They weren't early on, and it's a nightmare for a director, for a TV director during that, because I think actually TV spectators don't notice it as much as when you're watching live, because directors generally are so clever with cutting away from it, with leaving replays running a bit longer so that the beginning of the service motion, the first few bounces, you don't see because they're sort of taken up by replays and so on. So good directors will sort of divert your attention from it. It's one of those things that if you don't watch tennis live that much and you suddenly watch Djokovic live for the first time, you go, wow, he really does bounce the ball a lot. So it's hard to, so they weren't commenting on it throughout, but once it got to sort of midway through the second set, they did start commenting on it a lot because it was so unavoidably obvious. It really was obvious that he was, I mean, we're talking, you know, 18 times.
Really? See, I was kind of watching it whilst cooking, which is what I often do when I'm watching or following tennis matches. So I was kind of, I was probably doing my little chores while the ball bouncing was going on, and then going and having a look at the point. So I wasn't, I didn't really have the sound loud enough to follow the exactly the details. So I didn't actually know that that had been going on. I hadn't really noticed. But now you mention it, if you think back 6 or 7 years, I mean, the difference over the last few years has been stark. There's no question. I mean, he used to do it even more than that. I mean, it was awkward, actually. And it was awkward for him because I think it is a kind of, there was a darts player that couldn't let go of the dart when he was stressed, when he was about to throw, called Eric Bristow. And they used to call that dartitis, and certain
dart-itis.
Putters. Yeah. Certain golfers have problems with their putting stroke like that. They can't start the stroke almost, and I think that's certainly how it felt to me when I used to watch him doing it, and I didn't realize that had come back into his game. So
I noticed it in the US Open final last year that he was bouncing the ball more again, but then I didn't know whether, you know, I watched that in person for the full four sets, and I didn't know whether that was just because, you know, I was sat there watching a full tennis match, really concentrated on it live, or whether, and I'm used to seeing, you know, bits here and there, and mostly on the telly, et cetera, et cetera. I couldn't distill out the extraneous factors. But yesterday it did really strike me. Hey, he won the match, so who cares? Why should he care? But it is an interesting talking point, and it's a very minor sign of weakness, I suppose, depending on your interpretation. You know, think about Jo Konta's she has a great serve, but that service motion, if you're designing a service motion, that's not, you don't want to be doing that sort of hesitation before a serve. You want to be a Andy Roddick wham bam, don't you? You know, no moments hesitation. I can just do this without thinking about it. I'm not churning it over in my mind. It is,
yeah.
I suppose it's a minor sign of humanity in a sport where basically those at the top seem far from human most of the time.
All of Konta's ticks, I think, are comfort blankets, really, are just things that she's developed that make her feel okay when she goes up to serve. And as long as they work, absolutely fine. If you think, I mean, there have been so many weird serves. I was watching, I was doing some editing on an old match with Boris Becker, and I mean, his soaring motion on the serve and the preparation involved in that. I mean, you know, I don't think we used to really put clocks on how long people like him, and Jimmy Connors was another one who bounced the ball a heck of a lot. And it feels to me, as long as Djokovic and Nadal certainly take between serves, it feels to me that there's actually less dead time than there used to be when I look back at those old videos.
Don't agree with that. I really don't agree with that. I think possibly on the service motion, I'd agree with you. The problem now we have is there's so much more fannying around with towels and face wiping. Thanks, Greg Rozetsky. That's the issue. You're possibly right in terms of the service motion, that has always been an issue with some players. You know, some players will have a longer service motion and more ticks attached to it. But now in modern tennis, there's a lot more time between points doing other stuff.
I'll send you some of this footage, Catherine. You can have a look for yourself.
Okay. You're trying to tell me Greg Rozetsky's not to blame for everything?
No, I definitely agree with the towels one. The towels one. The other thing that is really notable when you see some of those old tapes is the lack of camaraderie and goodwill at the end of matches. I mean, there's barely a look to one another. There's a very cursory handshake. I mean, there's none of this hugs and patting on the stomach and patting on the head. And
you don't like any of that, do you, David?
I do get quite rid of the patting. I like the aggro. If it's genuine, I mean, if you look back at the old tapes and when there's real aggro, I liked it. I didn't like the seeming lack of emotion at certain points. I really enjoy all the emotion that's out there now. I still want that aggro as well. Don't like it being too cozy for the sake of coziness. But, you know, I think it's become a bit more accessible. You can feel how the players are feeling these days just by watching, which I enjoy. Anyway, so... It was a good old match. We're going to talk a bit later, Catherine, about matches, favourite matches styles-wise. And there was a lot of people, and maybe it's just not fans of Djokovic and Murray, but there's a lot of people that don't particularly enjoy their matches styles-wise. How do you feel about their matches in terms of just the sheer styles?
Well, it's exhausting. There's no doubt about that. I mean, as I said, nap requirements. I completely understand. I happen to enjoy it, but I do completely understand. I think I happen to enjoy it, but it's not my most favoured matchup. I don't think it's the most aesthetically pleasing matchup out there. If you're a fan of the sheer mental and physical battle of tennis, I think it's a great matchup. If you're more of a fan of the aesthetic style of tennis and shot making, is not the best matchup. So just depends on your, you know, what flavor you like. So I completely understand those people that think it's not the best. As objectively fantastic a match as that was yesterday, I understand if people didn't massively enjoy watching it, if that makes sense.
It does. And in pole vaults, Catherine, you'll be pleased to know, I've been asking... Oh, did you hear that groan, everybody? In pole vaults, we are going to be discussing a certain player's...
It's a very loose we.
I've asked people who care on Twitter, in pole vault, which players' rivalries make for the best matches. So does Djokovic against Federer or Murray or Nadal or Wawrinka? Anyway, that's for later, Catherine, in pole vault. We can let you have a nap during that point because you sound like you need one. Anyway, we've got loads of tournaments to discuss. And Grigor Dimitrov, you talk about styles. Dimitrov against Nishikori is one of my favourite matchups in many ways because...
It's taken you 16 minutes to mention Dimitrov, David. 16 minutes.
Did you like my hashtag the other day?
I don't pay attention to hashtags, David.
Right.
How long have you known me? No, I don't know what you're talking about.
My hashtag was, and I can actually sing this if you like. Would you like me to sing it? Because it's a play on words from...
I'll tell you how much I wouldn't like you to sing it.
Would everybody else like me to sing it? I'll take that as a yes. So anyway, Dimitrov, this is my hashtag. How do you solve a problem like Dimitrov?
Oh, God, it happened. It actually happened.
What is that from, Catherine? You can remember that, can't you?
It's from my nightmares, first and foremost.
Sound of music, Catherine. Sound of music. How do you solve a problem like Maria? It's been developed and changed into how do you solve a problem like Dimitrov. And as you can tell, I actually stumbled over the words during the song. So it didn't go quite as I anticipated. But anyway, that is a question I asked during the off-season when I was struggling to cope with no tennis. And it frankly feels like he's made a major step here to me. I mean, this is his first title in 2.5 years. He beat 3 top 10 players in the space of a week. He beat 3 all of last year. He beat Milos Raonic. He beat Kei Nishikori. He beat Dominic Thiem. First week of the year, I don't feel as though they are fully loaded players at that point. So I think you have to factor that in. But the level he found was the level he was playing at 3 years ago under Roger Rashid when he was fully focused, when he was up for it, when he seemed to have got himself super fit and super interested. And this was definitely a return to that sort of level, in my view. What do you think?
Yes, Dominic Thiem, who's bobbing on to play Sydney, by the way. Just
I heard Dominic Thiem had been having 12-hour practice sessions.
Yeah, because more tennis is definitely what he requires. Yeah, definitely. Okay, no, Grigor Dimitrov deserves our full attention here. Yeah, I agree with you. It's only the fact that we've said this before that is holding me back from being full on excitable about it. Because, yeah, I agree with everything. It was quite, for an ATP 250 level win from a player that has already won several ATP 250 level titles, it was quite an emotional celebration, I thought. And I was pleased about that because it is big. It really is big for him. And I'm glad he was okay to show that. I'm glad his attitude wasn't, oh, it's only a 250, because I think it's big. And I was pleased to see that emotion from him. I was pleased, you know, he's always been okay with wearing his heart on his sleeve, hasn't he? You know, he referenced that he feels happier and more comfortable and more focused and all the rest of it on the court this year. And you 100% believe him, don't you? Well, I certainly do. I don't feel like they're platitudes coming from him. It's all, you know, it's all raw emotion. There's no doubt that being with Danny Valverde, regardless of any tactical prowess he's bringing, and I'm sure he's bringing that as well, he's a happy, comfortable man on the tennis court with Danny Valverde in his corner, which I think for Grigor Dimitrov is as important as anything else. He definitely looks fit. For me, the issue with Grigor Dimitrov has been shot selection, decision making on the court. I mean, he has every shot, he has every skill, he has all the talent you could ever want. He got himself physically in shape. He sorted out that side of his game a few years ago with Roger Rashid, and I think by and large he's kept up with that even in the post-Rashid era. It's been his decision making. It's like watching Roger Federer but without the tennis brain, you know. He doesn't pick the right shots at the right time. He's the tennis equivalent of Theo Walcott. And I'm still torn about whether that can be corrected by any coach or by any training regime or by any tactic. I think that will always be a fundamental issue for him. But he does seem to be minimising the deficit of that, and that is very pleasing.
It is. Well, I think talking to a number of coaches and commentators who've watched him over the last couple of years, that the common thread has been people think he just hasn't got a reliable way of winning points, you know, a go-to pattern of points. Every top player seems to have that, and he's lacked it. He can do all these fancy Dan shots, but what does he go to when he's under pressure to win in points? And I think he had that 3 years ago under Rashid. Big serve, massive forehand. Anything else left over, come in and finish it off. It's pretty straightforward. He wasn't overcomplicating things. And I think he moved away from that. And I think his fitness was preventing him from doing what he wanted to do. And I think his focus was preventing him from doing what he wanted to do. And then he started to get the scar tissue associated with all these losses. And he was losing matches he was destined to win and didn't win them, and you know, I think he lost his way, completely lost his way. I mean, he could have disappeared without trace. So I think that's quite gutsy that he decided to go back to basics a bit with Danny Valverde. That's what it feels like to me. And I watched the one I watched closely was the one against Milos Raonic, and Raonic was playing well first set. That set could have gone either way. In many ways, I thought Raonic was going to win it, and Dimitrov used the slice a lot. He just blunted the power a bit on the return of Raonic, and I thought, crikey, he's using his brain here. He's actually playing tactically. He's being given tactics and he's following them. And I enjoyed that performance, and I think he's played brilliantly all week. It's 1 week. Ultimately, it's 1 week. He may do nothing else all year. This may be the height of his year, but it did make the heart sing for a few hours, I must say, over the course of the week. And for anybody that's liked him and liked his potential, and we certainly have, as anybody who's listened to this show over the years will know. And let's just hope he does take that into the Australian Open, because if he does, it'd be fun, wouldn't it? I don't know how far it'd get him, but it'd be nice to see.
Oh, yeah, without question. There's very few people that don't want to see him fulfil his potential, whatever that might be. There's great goodwill towards him in tennis. So, yeah, I mean, he really should be making fourth round. And then from there, we'll see. But he really should be disappointed with anything that's not second week in Australia.
Yeah. Yeah, Nishiguri, another good run for him, getting to the final. Of course, other tournaments we had on the men's side, we had victory for Roberto Bautista Agut in Chennai over, is it Danny Medvedev?
Danil Medvedev.
Somebody, I must admit, I have not seen play before. Somebody reminds me that he's actually one of the blokes that Marcus Willis beat on the way to where he got to at Wimbledon. Sarah tells me on Twitter, he's very young, cool, great attitude on court, won a lot on the Challenger Tour last year, and it's nice to see him at the ATP level now. Well, it certainly is nice to see him on the ATP level now. And what we know, Catherine, is Yevgeny Kafelnikov tweets about him every 5 minutes.
Yeah. In Russian, what he's saying, which is really unhelpful, Yevgeny. Thanks. He's somebody that's taken his time to make the he's not to try to sort of break through, and he's not taking lots of wild cards. As you say, he's been playing on the challenger level. He's inside the top 100, actually. He's ranked 99, isn't he? So he's doing just fine. 20 years old, so a tiny bit older than Yezverev's, but still in this very much in the same category, and by all accounts very talented, and 6'6" as well. It does seem to be that the era of the taller than average tennis player is coming back a bit, doesn't it?
Which is nice,
because
I've got
company. Anybody that's fallen into, I spent a lot of time googling Dmitry Medvedev and was confused about why only not tennis results were coming up. Turns out that is the name of the Russian Prime Minister, and this the tennis guy is Daniil Medvedev. So don't fall into the same trap I did.
See, public service here on the Tennis Podcast. Catherine Whittaker warning you off inadvertent Googling as well.
I'm probably on now some kind of GCHQ database, aren't I? Because I've been aggressively Googling
Russian
politicians. Yeah.
Yes. Now, on the women's side, Karolina Pliskova won in Brisbane and frankly looked pretty awesome. I commentated on a couple of her matches for BT Sport, and she against Roberta Vinci, I thought she was going to lose. She'd never won a set against her. She lost her fifth set in a row against her by losing the first one, and didn't know what to do against the slice and angled spins of Vinci, but eventually found a way, overpowered her, got to the final and thrashed Elise Cornet, who'd had a great week up until that point. And it was interesting when we ran the poll that you would have loved, Catherine, a couple of weeks ago, of who's going to win the Australian Open. Is it going to be Serena, Kerber, or someone else? And someone else actually got the highest number of votes. And a lot of people were pointing towards Pliskova as the one they thought could be the one. I mean, I don't know. I think she's certainly capable, but can she put it all together? She has once, I suppose, getting to the final of the US Open.
I think if you can win six matches in a row against top opposition, you can win seven if the time's right. So I certainly think she can. The win in Brisbane makes me certain that she can. I was very impressed with her. Vinci is a horrible matchup for her. Pliskova is somebody that, when she looks good and when the matchup is good, she makes it look so easy. Like, oh yeah, you can just serve big and out hit anybody, and yeah, of course you're going to win every tennis match. And when she comes up against somebody crafty that exposes her slightly weaker movement, she can look really lumbering and one dimensional. And Vinci in the past has done that to her. And the fact that she's now figuring out, you know, keeping her focus and figuring out a way to win those matches, for me, is a very, very good sign. And I think, you know, I'm not tipping her as the favourite to win the Aussie Open, but she's in the second. She's a prominent member of the second tier of people, which includes everybody, all the good people, except for Kerber and Serena. So that's pretty good going. Probably third, fourth favourite.
Do you want to know who I'm picking for the Australian Open, Catherine? Do you want to know who I'm picking?
Surprise me, David.
I'm going to give you an early pick, 1 week out. Now, this is gutsy, huh? Here we go. Garbiñe Muguruza.
Why?
I watched her play last week, commentated on her. She looked super fit. She looked really motivated. You know, sometimes Muguruza can kind of, you know, wander about the court, not looking... Well, not that she doesn't look bothered, but that she just looks so above it all, as though she I mean, it's great to believe in yourself, but it can almost look as though she's too self-assured. And I like the fact, and I think that you need some of that, no question, but I like the fact that she seemed really pumped up. She ended up losing, I think, deciding to retire during a match in about the semis. But I think she looks really up for this, and I'm going for Muguruza for the title.
I think that's a very good description of what can be frustrating about, or what has been frustrating about watching Muguruza in the past year or so, that she is a bit unnervingly self-assured. And you want to see someone on a tennis court who needs tennis as much as tennis needs them. You know, that's, I think, the secret of Roger Federer's adoration. Yes, you know, everybody talks about how much tennis desperately needs him and will struggle after he's gone. But as evidenced by, well, the fact that he's still out there as much as anything else, he needs tennis as much as we all need him. And you've had that feeling with Muguruza over the past year or so that she, I don't know, gives the impression that tennis needs me more than I need tennis, maybe. So to see her needing it and wanting it is great. She's not my favourite, though.
Who is? Who are you picking?
I don't think there is a clear favourite. I really don't. Who am I picking? I think
Do you need that extra week? We've got our preview show. We've got our pre-draw or post-draw preview show next Friday when we arrive in Melbourne, Catherine, just before our Kickstarter closes on the Saturday. Don't forget that. And then we're hoping to get all the daily podcasts done if we can. We're nearly there. We've just got about 25% to go or whatever it is. Anyway, Catherine, you don't have to pick right now. You don't have to be as gutsy as I've been.
All right, then. Give me an opt-out from predictions and I will take it.
But I do get extra credit, obviously, having gone so early, as and when I'm proven right.
Yes, you will. Your foolhardiness will be rewarded if Muguruza wins.
And I also don't get as much stick if she doesn't win.
No, that's not how it works.
Oh, okay. Now, elsewhere, we had... Katerina Siniakova, and we've had a little discussion about how you pronounce her name. I'm going with that. In Shenzhen, having the most wonderful week. Did she beat Radvanska as well? I can't remember. But it was Alison Risk who beat Radvanska. But Siniakova beat Joe Konta in the semis and ended up winning the whole thing. Fantastic week for her.
Yeah, her first WTA Tour titles. That's pretty big for her. Good time of the year to do it as well, going into a Grand Slam, which is, you know, pretty open, as just discussed, as evidenced by the fact that you're picking Muguruza to win it. I'm not saying she's going to win the Australian Open. I'm just saying, you know, it is historically a Grand Slam where there is usually a sort of, or there has been in previous years on the women's side, a young breakthrough, hasn't there? There was Bouchard, there was Sloane Stephens, there was Madison Keys, you know. So, yeah, well done her. And you know, I was a bit disappointed for Joe Konta when she lost to Siniakova, however you want to say it. But it looks a bit better for Joe Konta now. It sounds better to have lost to the eventual champion than to have lost to an unseeded player, doesn't it? So
I know that's what hurt about losing to you is that, I mean, you've never won anything in your life. And I mean, I still lost to you. So, you know, it was even worse, really. Anyway, Lauren Davis, 5'2" tall. That's got to be the shortest winner of a WTA event ever. Magnificent win for her to win in Auckland, and she's from America. She's beaten Anna Konyu, the upcoming Croatian player, big hitter, and Davis beat her. I think that's a heck of a performance from her.
I do wonder if, I mean, this is purely theory. I have not done the scientific data modelling required to prove this, but I do wonder if there's some kind of something in the fact that, you know, they had horrible weather in Auckland this week, didn't they? I really felt for them. Horrible winds, you know. So Serena was pretty outspoken about it. She said, "I just want to get out of here." She said they were the worst conditions she'd pretty much ever played in.
She said, "I abhor this place's weather."
She said, "Abhor." Yeah. I mean, I feel for her. I would rather not play tennis than play tennis in the wind. But that's because I'm so lacking in skill. I think it shows up the unskilled.
Well, I'm playing you in the wind then.
But yeah, they had a bit of a nightmare this week. And I do wonder if, you know, the low centre of gravity, is this making any sense? I wonder if that, you know, favours the shorter, more compact, less of a big swing type player, perhaps.
And you don't want to play against me in those conditions?
No, I didn't say that. I said I'd rather play tennis not in wind than in wind. I didn't say anything about playing you.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, there you go. Just a theory to posit.
I see. Okay. Well, thank you for that theory. It's a cracking win anyway for Lauren Davis in those windy conditions. And in the Hopman Cup, last but not least, Catherine, won by France, who seem, as usual, pretty good at team competitions. I mean, I think the event will be remembered for Federer's return as much as anything. But Richard Gasquet beating Jack Sock in the final, and then Kristina Mladenovic going down to Coco Vandeweghe, and then they ended up winning the mixed doubles over the Fast Four format, which has had mixed reviews as a way of deciding who would win that tournament. But the Hopman Cup, yeah, it seemed to go pretty happily overall.
Yeah, I mean, I think just it can't go wrong when you've got Federer, and let alone when you've got all eyes on Federer because it's his comeback tournament. I mean, it was always going to be a winner of a tournament. So they must be delighted about how this week has gone. Fast fours, I could take it or leave it, really. I don't have any massive objection to it. I applaud trying something new. I've got no problem with trying something. I don't think it's a disaster or a bad thing. I just think it's not really solving any of the perceived problems either. I think it's, you know, meh, fine, okay, yeah, but not wow, yeah, what's this great new format that's, yeah. But anyway, that's, yeah, it's not that big a thing. Federer, he looked good, didn't he? I'm not worried about the loss to Zverev. I think a tight match like that is exactly what he would have wanted. Of course, he would have wanted to win it, but getting a really close competitive match under his belt was as important as anything, I think. And so I think he'll be leaving Perth feeling pretty buoyant, really.
Yeah, I'd have thought so too. I mean, as long as they're all fit, I mean, I think Rafael Nadal looked really good for a few days. He ended up going down to, he had one bad patch against Raonic, which did make me think, oh, that's a little more reminiscent of the guy we've seen the last couple of years where he gets nervous or slightly loses his control on the forehand side. But I think he's looked good. I mean, it is bubbling up nicely. You just hope they all end up going there fit and ready to go. Catherine, I think it's time for pole vault, isn't it? Have you got anything else to say?
Not now, I don't, no.
Hey, I tell you what, before we get into pole vault, here's something I do want to know. Why does nobody ever pick Stan Wawrinka to win anything? It's really winding me up.
Because he's never the favourite. I mean,
what do you mean? I don't know. He's won three Grand Slam titles in the last 3 years. He's won the last Grand Slam tournament. He's won as many as Andy Murray. He's beaten Novak Djokovic in two Grand Slam finals in the last 18 months. Why do people not pick him to win the thing? More people pick Federer and Nadal to win than him.
Well, are you picking him to win the Australian Open then?
Might do.
Are you?
I haven't decided yet.
Okay. Maybe let's revisit this conversation.
Well, look, I went on the ESPN.com tennis website, and it's a good website. There was a really good Australian Open preview, and they got five respected writers together on tennis to all put their winners. and for every Grand Slam this year, every single one. So you got five people, four picks each for them. Not one of them picked Wawrinka. They're picking other people ahead of that. You know, people picked Nick Kyrgios to win the US Open, but not Stan Wawrinka to win anything.
Because he's as liable to go out early as he is to win something. Once he gets into the semi-finals, you know, once you're picking from a last four, you might start picking Wawrinka, but he's difficult to pick week one. I mean, I don't, the stats don't back you up, I don't think, David. Are you picking him to win a slam this year?
I haven't decided yet.
Right, okay. Okay, again, probably a conversation to be revisited.
Fine, well, we will. But, you know, I think it's a bit out of order. I'm fed up of him not being part of the conversation. I'm fed up of this talk of a big four. And why isn't
he
it a big five?
He's in the conversation. You can...
No, he's not. He's, when is he in the... people call it a big four and not a big five. What do you call it? Some people call it a big three.
I don't actually use that turn of phrase very often. But Andy Murray is distinguished from Stan Wawrinka because of his consistency on tour throughout the year, and Stan Wawrinka has agreed with that himself many a time in the past. So I think that's the end of the debate. That's why Murray is distinguished year round.
Okay, all right, I'll let that go for now.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life, and of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. Now, pole vault, I wanted to know which of the very top players, and I'm including the big five in this, which of their rivalries are making for the best matches? Because I find it fascinating that people were getting critical of the Andy Murray against Djokovic style of match. You know, it just wasn't doing it for some people at all. So I asked the question, which match makes the best one? So let's start with Andy Murray, shall we? Which of his matches do you prefer watching most? Andy Murray against Djokovic, Federer, Nadal or Wawrinka?
Well, on the whole, I like to watch Andy Murray win because I'm British. So
that's not the point.
Is it not?
Styles of matches. Which do you prefer to watch the most?
Matches. Federer, probably. Quite like him against Nadal. Him against Nadal is good as well.
59% of 778 votes said they like seeing Murray against Djokovic the most. But I mean, people were outspoken beyond that in response, saying they don't like the rivalry. But the actual voting gave 59% to that.
Well, I do think it's a pretty subjective thing. So, you know, I accept that. Yeah,
24% like watching Murray against Federer. And then Nadal's in third of 12%, and then 5% for Wawrinka. What about Djokovic? Which of his rivalries? This was much more evenly split, by the way, but in terms of the pole vault.
I really like watching him play Wawrinka.
Oh, really?
Personally, yeah. I really like those matchups.
Least popular, according to pole vault, 16%, but it's pretty evenly split. 31% like seeing him play Nadal, 29% like seeing him play Federer, and 24% like seeing him play Murray. I agree with you about Wawrinka. I find that a fascinating contrast. You know, this big puncher almost against the all accomplished jab and move artist of Djokovic, but I'd probably go for Federer against Djokovic. I love seeing that contrast in styles. I love trying to see Federer unlock Djokovic somehow, and he has to be so inspirational to do it because of Djokovic's movement and consistency. I think they've made for some great ones. What about Federer's best rivalry? I mean, just about too many. 43% go for the Nadal one for Federer. But I wouldn't say that they always, although they've played the best match I've ever seen, I don't think the others on the whole are as good as Federer against Djokovic.
Oh, I mean, maybe I'm being over sentimental. Because let's face it, Federer-Nadal matchups are less present in my mind than Federer-Djokovic ones because there hasn't been one for so long, and there certainly hasn't been a Grand Slam one for so long. So I have to say Federer Nadal, really. But yeah, the Federer Djokovic ones have been great. They have been great matches. You know, the Wimbledon final of 2014,
I think.
Djokovic two sets love up, Federer came back to two sets all, you know, that was a classic. US Open final of 2015 was a classic. Yeah, I mean, they're all good, aren't they? They're all pretty good.
They are good. I also asked hashtag my favorite matchup generally, not just those guys. What other matches do you love watching? We've got a few here. Megan says she likes to see Vika or Venus. I can't believe I said Vika. Azarenka or Venus against Serena Williams. We have got Arno, who says he likes to see Nadal against Stan Wawrinka for a baseline match. For a serve and volley match, he loved watching Federer against Sampras. That was a good one from 2001 at Wimbledon, of course. On the women's side, Ennan against Serena used to be great matches. I'd agree with that. And a couple of shouts for Maresmo as well against Serena and Radvanska. I do love styles mate matches. They do, don't they? I used to like watching Agassi-Sampras. That used to be an absolute favourite of mine, to watch this incredible returner and baseliner up against the big hitter and the seven volleyer.
Yeah, I'll go with that. I used to like, I mean, I suppose the era of them meeting at the top of the game is pretty short, but I used to like watching Safin and Hewitt play, if that's not too random. That sort of, I mean, and Safin against Santoro, those matches were good as well. It's the contrast, isn't it? Contrast makes for great tennis when both players are at their best. And that's probably why some people don't adore Murray Djokovic matches.
Yeah, probably is. Yeah, I would say there's some truth in that. So, Catherine, that's about it, really, isn't it, for the tennis podcast for the first week of the year. We are now going to relocate, aren't we? We've just got the 24 hours to go of a journey to get to Australia. How many films have you got lined up?
I have got a whole series of Humans on from Channel 4, which I neglected to watch when it was on. I've got the Christmas episode of Sherlock, and I have the last series of Catastrophe, which I've already seen but want to watch again. So, and a whole, I think I've got three or four episodes of my favourite podcast apart from this one.
I was going to say, I've got 36 episodes of the Tennis Podcast to listen to from the back catalogue. I could have had 260.
I don't have a favourite podcast apart from this one, except that I
obviously. And I hope you, after listening to 45 minutes of this one, that you still agree that you like this Tennis Podcast. If you do, we're trying to, as you know, fund daily editions of the Tennis Podcast at the Grand Slam tournaments. We're definitely doing 45 shows, weekly shows, over the course of the next 12 months because of you lot, because of the funds you've been able to raise for us to keep this going. Kickstarter.com, search Tennis Podcast if you'd like to pledge. There's another 5.5 days left before the deadline. It all ends at on Saturday at noon, 12 o'clock midday UK time. So what's that, about 7 in the morning in the States, and goodness knows what time in the middle of the night in Australia on Saturday. But we're nearing the limit. If you can get us over the line, then we'll be able to do daily shows throughout the Grand Slams this year. 45 of those to add to the 45 weekly shows. And Catherine has also, you may want to have a quick read of this as well, Catherine's written a blog about how this podcast came about. And I get all sorts of stick.
No, you don't. No, it speaks very fondly of David Law, my blog. It does.
Okay, we must have read it in a different way then.
Oh, well, you be your own judge, dear listener. Okay. But
I read it that I'd sort of made you do the podcast about 4.5 years ago.
No, you didn't. No. I said, okay, with an exclamation mark. Read the blog, guys. You'll understand what we're talking about.
You can't get tones of voice. I need to get you to do the audiobook version of your own blog for me so that I know exactly what you meant, don't I? But anyway, I'm only joking, everybody. She's very nice about me, really. Do go and have a look at it. It is called For the Love of Pod. That is the name of Catherine's blog. You can read that.
I can't believe it's called that.
Oh, it's a good title. It wasn't thought up by me. It was Catherine's brother who came up with that wonderful title. One day we're going to get Rosie to write a blog as well. That is also in the works. I'm going to do one too. Kickstarter.com. Have a look at Tennis Podcast page. In the updates there, you'll be able to find our blogs. They're also linked from our Twitter page. We're on Facebook and Instagram. Been posting all sorts of stuff on there, Catherine, as you can probably imagine. Have you had a look at any of those channels at all?
Instagram. I dread to think what you've been doing on Tennis Podcast Instagram, David.
Yeah, you wouldn't like it, I promise you. Probably best you don't have a look. But anyway, Catherine, have a good trip to Australia. We will be back, I reckon, about Friday, Saturday, previewing the draws. And it'll be hot, and I'll be struggling with jet lag. Looking forward to that?
I'll be complaining about being sweaty.
You will.
Can't wait.
Catherine will be there for Eurosport, covering the Australian Open every step of the way. Eurosport have exclusive TV rights in the UK, so they'll be bringing all the action from the Australian Open. I'll be there for BBC Radio 5 Live. We will have live commentary, particularly of the evening session, morning time in the UK. Tennis Breakfast will be on most days of the tournament as well. So we'll be bringing you all the best flavours from there on BBC Radio 5 Live and 5 Live Sports Extra. Do follow that. Catherine and I will be back with podcasts. Catherine, travel well. Speak to you soon.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.